Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the Psychovertical Podcast. I'm your host, Andy Kirkpatrick. This is the end of the week episode. I've decided to call it the end of the week episode because I don't know what day I'm going to post it, but hopefully you should be listening to this on a Thursday. But if you're not, then, you know, who knows when you're listening to it. So, so this is the slightly... Well, this is usually like a slightly longer podcast, but my wife is like locked in the room next door because she said she can't come out because I'm doing a podcast and she wants to come out, so I can't keep her there for too long. So so what's my news? It is absolutely freezing here in this unidentified Arab country. It's really, really cold. Like, I'm sat here with a blanket on and I've just like my feet are freezing. You can see why you think the buildings here would be quite good in the cold, because you'd imagine they're really insulated for the heat, because it gets up to like 50 plus degrees in the summertime. But they don't seem to be. Like, everyone's going around today like freezing their asses off. Like, no one seems to be able to dress very well. I think Arabs seem to be a little bit, they don't seem to like the cold for some reason. I was getting a coffee today and the woman next to me was like in the full on burqa and everything. And she was like shivering and freezing cold. So burqa's aren't very warm either. I can see why. I don't know if everyone has anybody ever read Bravo 2.0, the book, which is better on the second read, as Alan Partridge said, about the SAS, the kind of semi-fictional, well, probably very fictional story of the SAS in the desert in Iraq. But two of them like died of hypothermia. I think it was two of them. One of them died of hypothermia in the desert. Another one died, I think he swam across the Euphrates or something and died of hypothermia. But I've really noticed it here a few times. It's really, can get really cold, like at night. I know people always say like, oh yeah, in the desert it's really cold at night, but it's when the wind blows. I don't know why. You think if it was, there's more moisture, it would in the wind, it would be colder. But it could be quite tough. I met someone who told me that in the Gulf War, all the soldiers got this like advice that it was going to be like really warm in the desert, and it wasn't, and they all like just froze, and they had these like chemical NBC suits, nuclear biological chemical, like charcoal impregnated sort of clothing for if there was like a chemical attack. Like, anyone who grew up in the 80s and the 90s in the UK, like if you were like a crusty student, people would walk around wearing these like NVC, army surplus NVC smocks. Anybody remember that? Like these green, green things, which were impregnated with charcoal. So if you're a student, you might have survived. But people started wearing those all the time because it was so cold. And I think the SAS and people out in the desert, they eventually got hold of loads of like really thick sort of sheepskin like jackets. You see them here, they go down to like your knees, like a huge big thing, like a massive like belay jacket. And if you look at like photographs in some of these old books about the Gulf War, you'll see them wearing these like big massive jackets. I don't know, probably bulletproof as well. Big sheep are quite tough. So yeah, it's funny. It's funny when you mention the war here. Like no one seems to. I guess there's been quite a few wars. I think if you talk about the Gulf War, people generally in the Gulf. I think often people think about the Iran and Iraq war, not Gulf War I and Gulf War II. So, yeah, I guess there's a lot. Yeah, wars. There's wars all the time. Yeah, wars. I guess even like Second World War. Like I actually went to see 1917 and the cinema. And just people were like just talking all the way through it. Like all these people are like yabbering, talking to each other the whole way through it. It's intensely annoying. And then before it even finished, everyone started leaving the cinema. Like the guy had just told, I don't want to spoil it for you, but the guy had just told this guy's brother what happened. And, you know, it's like super emotional. And everyone just putting the popcorn down and just all walking out and stuff, which is... you know, it's kind of weird. Like when it went to see Jumanji 2, which was not good. I don't know why I went to see Jumanji 2. Maybe like here in this country, loads of things are cut out of the films. Everyone's kissing someone or whatever. Like in the Joker, like the kiss is like cut out and all this kind of stuff. So you often wonder like, are they just cutting out all the bits which are funny or something? Like, is there loads of like jokes about God or something? Or, you know, like why is it just so bad? It's like, you know, really, yeah, it's kind of a really incredible how bad stuff can be at the moment. Like, you know, TV, you know, and this kind of stuff. Like Netflix. Has anybody? I can't remember the last. Apart from the last, was it the? Anyway, the King at Beasts of No Nations. Where it was, you know, like that was a. Anything with Netflix on it at the moment just seems to be like terrible. So anyway, so I've got really bad internet here. So I keep trying to do interviews with people, but I just can't get them to work. So I'm going to keep trying. I might have to just do it. Like if you try and do it anywhere where there's good internet, there's always too much noise. So I don't know how I'm going to do it. I may have to just wait till I get back down. I'm trying to do an interview with a friend of mine who's like, I've mentioned it before, he's like rowing across the Atlantic and he's building his own boat, which is like super cool. And I want to talk to him about, you know, like taking on a big project and basically how you're going to stay comfortable and psychological stuff about rowing across the Atlantic, North Atlantic, not the South Atlantic. Oh, anyone could do that. You know, even a German kayaked across, like how hard could it be? But this is like proper North Atlantic kind of stuff. And I also want to interview Ian Parnell, who has just finished redoing classic rock, or was it hard rock? Anyway, it's a book with the word rock in it, so which looks really, really cool. So if you check that out, hard rock, classic rock, some kind of rock, Ian Parnell. So hopefully I'll try and interview him as well, and we'll get him to like read a bit. Like Ian used to be a bell ringer, so you know that's not a euphemism. So yeah, he's very well spoken. He's you know, I used to think he was posh, but that's because I was just ignorant. So yeah, and for some reason I have this little notebook. It's a good tip for anybody out there. It's a good tip in that I always carry a notebook around with me, and the reason I do is I have a lot of like random thoughts in my head, and I try and write them down. And the only reason I do it is David Lynch does it. And I heard David Lynch say it, and I thought, I'm going to do that. So I've actually started doing it. I'm carrying it around for quite a long time. I'll probably lose it before I ever write down any of these notes. Like I've actually set up another Instagram account, and I'm just going to write down the notes next to a picture. Like that's how I used to do Instagram before, when I used to have loads of wacky photographs and nothing to do with climbing. And it was just basically, I used to write down stuff that came into my head, or stuff I saw, and just did it via Instagram because I thought it was kind of more creative. But the problem is my handwriting is so terrible. I literally can hardly read anything I've written, like facts don't equal truth. I can read that. The necessity of illusion. Who slaves should the poor be? Oh, God. Like, it's just like, that's not too bad, but some of it is just terrible. But what was cool was last time I saw my son, Ewan, we're walking along and suddenly he, like, whipped out this little notebook. And I was like, how come you got a notebook? And he's like, oh, you told me that I should get a notebook, so I've got a notebook. So that was cool. I don't know if he's going to keep it, but yeah. Anyway, notebooks, really, really good idea, I reckon. Carry a little pen, notebook, little ideas, little sketches. There's a really good guy I've been following on Instagram who's a Chinese drawer, Chinese artist. He just does these really cool little sketches in a notebook, which are super, super cool. Like, just, you know, like, it's really, really simple stuff. One of my favorite artists out there is the guy, I can't remember his name now. He basically has gone into his granddad's shed and he's like drawing every single item in that shed, like one at a time. He's like a really good illustrator. If you type in granddad's shed illustrate, you'll find it. See, I'm just full of like really great links for you to, you know, to go and find. I've seen a few people have been downloading this Vapor Barrier Sock PDF, which is on Gumroad. So, because I mentioned that in the last podcast about Vapor Barrier Socks. So thank you for downloading that. I don't get paid for it, but thank you for downloading it. On the subject, I should probably mention something here, because sometimes sometimes I can come across as a bit of someone who's a bit obsessed with money sometimes. So because I got like I had a comment from somebody. I'm just trying to see, my internet's so bad it won't even, can't even open Instagram. I had a comment from somebody and he was giving me some advice, and so I do apologize if you're giving me some advice, if I sounded like I was grumpy, that I should structure this podcast more carefully and various things like that. And thanks for sharing very useful insights, but could you please work on the structure that goes for both podcasts and books? In the beginning of this week's episode, you said you'd ramble less in the Techie Tuesday podcast. However, after 10 minutes, you're still rambling on about playing chess. Why not start with an old-fashioned agenda? Today I talk about A, B, C, and D. Although your storytelling is entertaining to some extent, that's really not what's unique about your podcast. I'm all ears about climbing, blah, blah, blah. I'm a very defensive person. Like, I'm, you know, I hate it when people say I'm thin-skinned, you know. So this is my reply to him, and I'm just gonna quickly say it. So he'll be fast-forwarding through this, but anyway, if I was being paid to do a podcast, I'd probably sit down and write out the entire thing and have it well-structured, as well as make it as perfect as can be, and have zero rambling. But as it is, I don't have time or can't afford to take the time, so I just press play and record what's in my head. So it's up to you to invest the same amount of time and effort or not to see if there's anything of any value. For me, in the rambling, a writer telling you that his dad stopped reading what he wrote as he thought his son had gone mad is of greater value than Vapor Barrier Socks. But everyone is different. And then I sort of went on another bit about when you're writing a book. So he was a bit critical. It was, you know, a good critical comment about my book Higher Education. That it sometimes has a few like repeated things like about your ideal rack or whatever. But when you're writing a book, like I'm really aware of this at the moment, is you're trying to, like, I think Higher Education is 200,000 words, you know, and when you've written it all and, you know, you've written it, you've illustrated and all that kind of stuff, you've been like, in this intense relationship with this book for such a long time, like a year, 2 years or something, trying to get it finished, that after a while it's just such a massive project, that book, that you, it's amazing there's not more mistakes in that kind of book, because you've not, if you're doing like systems analysis, you know, say you're building like a control panel in like a, in a jumbo jet or something, or some kind of aircraft, you need to do all this like system analysis to make sure that if this button's off and this button's on, what happens? And if these buttons are off and that one's on, what happens? And you sort of go through all this process of trying to weed out all these problems. But in a book, it's like so difficult. Like it would take me, you know, it took like 2 years to write the book. You know, to read the book properly would take me like a few days. Like even like Vanessa, my wife, like proofread it. And that took her like, you know, like a week or 2 weeks or something. Like it's just too big. It's just so big that there's always going to be like little mistakes in there. If you look at, a film like Suicide Squad or something, like everyone's going on about how badly, the thingy girls, cheeky girls, what it's called, how it's flopping. But, you know, you watch Suicide Squad and it's just bloody horrendous film. And it's like, whoever did the script was, same with the, like, by sounds of it, like the last Star Wars film, same kind of problem, is these things become so complicated and so complex that it's just going to happen, you know. Like the books I'm writing are not easy books to write. And they're not easy books to, they're just not easy books. And that's why people don't write books like this, because A, it takes too long. There's no money in it unless you do it the way I'm trying to do it, you know, where you have to do everything. You have to edit it, design it, you know, publish it, do it, you know, all this kind of stuff. So yeah, there's always going to be, you know, like imperfections and mistakes. But for me, I always think that the imperfections are the kind of the price you pay, you know, like what the highest highs, you know, if you go, like I was thinking about American food, if you go out for like some food in America, it's always to a standard that's just above acceptable, if you know what I mean. Anyone's been to America, you know what I'm talking about. Like it's never like, you know, sometimes you'll find somewhere like it's really, really amazing. And other times you'll find, but you'll very rarely find something which is really, really terrible, like you would if you're in the UK or somewhere else. But, you know, it's always to a standard. And that's the problem, is that the more you're risking going out, looking for something which is, I'm not saying what I do is like amazing, but I think when it's good, it's like really good. And sometimes it's crap, you know, sometimes I read stuff and I just see it's like badly spelled or it doesn't make any sense to me, even though I wrote it. So that's the problem really. It's just the nature of it really. But I wrote this little kind of reply to him on Instagram. I'm trying to be more positive. So I'll read this out. So one reason I keep reading things, I should point out, is that I want to do the audio versions of Psycho Vertical and Cold Wars and my other books, because about a third of all book sales these days are audio books. So it's been something I'm trying to do for ages, but I'm just like, I think I've told you in other podcasts, I'm really not very confident at reading things. So this is like something I have to kind of get over. So I'm just kind of using you, I'm just exploiting you all to just sit there, listen to me, like going there. So anyway, I'll just quickly read this little thing. This is of interest. So this is my reply to my man. So when David Lynch made Lost Highway, one critic said it deserved two thumbs down, to which Lynch replied that this was good enough reason to go and see the film. The idea of perfection can be a logjam, that it stops you growing, or just doing what you can, learning from it, then moving on, and not dwelling on if it was perfect, is one way never to become boring or bored, which is really what perfection is, boring. Like a beautiful woman is boring, a photorealistic painting, an Italian sports car. Yes, you can say that Beyoncé creates perfect music, 50 writers, 10 producers, no money spared. But compare it to the crackly, poor quality recording of Billie Holiday singing Strange Fruit. What is perfection? And yes, David Lynch never got to direct Return of the Jedi or the latest Transformers film, didn't become Spielberg, but has he never been one to waste time on art that left you in no doubt what it was, but rather the imperfection, the imperfect grasp of the interpretation. But in 100 years' time, they won't be listening to clinical perfection, the clinical perfection of Beyoncé, or discussing the films of Michael Bay. Art that gave people exactly what they wanted, like McDonald's, repeatably perfect for what it is. No, they'll be talking about Billie Holiday and Lynch, things that mean something we don't fully understand. So yeah, so that's my kind of like passive aggressive reply. I'm very conscious at the moment that about social media, because I put a lot of time into social media, because mainly that's the main way I get access to people out there like you lot and climbers and things. And I do see myself as being in service to climbing, which sounds a bit corny, but all my life that is kind of how I've always kind of seen it. You know, you're like, we're all in the same kind of tribe. But I sent like Hazel Finley, I was having a little, because I was this thing about like feeding the beast. Like basically when I first started being creative in the outdoors, you were being paid like 1p a word, you were being paid for your photographs, for magazines or companies. Like you even got to the point where you were being paid like $1 a word. So, you know, like it was like, there was this creative two-way thing between you, the editor, the magazine, the person who bought the magazine. And it worked very, very well. But those days have pretty much gone for most people. Like most people tend to be creating content for free on the hope that one day they're going to, they're going to be like a bum model. You know, they're going to have an Instagram account with like loads of people, you know, who follow it just because they're girlfriend's got like a nice arse, and you know she's pointing at something in the distance, like going with her tightest leggings on, going like, and it's got a really beautiful quote, but like no one's interested in the view, they're just like looking at this woman's arse, which is kind of how base these things are, really, you know. And but people try and pretend, this woman, she writes such beautiful things, and you look there and she's like a yoga instructor who wears like a pair of pants which are like tiny, you know. Yeah, that is, you know, that's not being sexist, that's just telling the truth of it. So I sent this message to Hazel Finley. This is not going to be me just like reading off loads of messages here off my thing, and my wife's like banging on the door now, she wants to be let out. It's like, do you ever feel social media is a form of slavery? Everyone is creating content for free in the hope that someday they might make back the money and time they invest in it. It's like a hobby that becomes a job, only one where you pay yourself. And Hazel replied, ha ha ha, not really, I get paid. So anyway, Hazel's got a podcast, by the way. I've not listened to it yet, but I shall do. But I'm sure it's very good. She's a very thoughtful person. You won't see any pictures of Hazel like pointing into the distance on Instagram, that's for sure. So yeah. So I'm not a money grabber. But these things are important. It's very important. Like anybody here, I remember once I met this woman who was like some sort of high-powered woman who lived in Chamonix. And I remember the door to a house probably cost more than the house I lived in at the time. And, you know, like lived in this giant mansion upon the hill in Chamonix. And I was kind of going through all my kind of highfalutin ideas about stuff. And I had this idea about doing a magazine, like climbing magazine or something. And it was like, oh yeah, blah, blah, blah. You know, money's not important, blah, blah, blah. And she was like, no, money is like the only thing that's important. You know, like if it doesn't make money, it won't exist or something. And that kind of always stuck in my mind. And another thing someone's told me was that money is fuel. I don't think of it as money, just think of it as fuel. And without fuel, you can't do anything. So any young people out there who want to make a living you know, doing stuff, you know, the financial side is something you should really take seriously, because if you don't, you'll just, you know, you'll just run out of steam, basically. So it's very important. And I do see a lot of people, you know, there's this thing that the baby boomers, if you listen to like the Portal and Eric Weinstein and people like that, you know, this idea that the baby boomers just literally kind of like screwed everybody over, you know, the Generation X and the millennials screwed you all over, basically. They've got all the money and all the houses and all the savings and all the pensions and everything else. It's not necessarily true, but you do see a lot. I do see a lot of people who are probably in their mid 20s who are like got super talented, but are just working a climbing wall or something. They just can't seem to get started, you know. So it's kind of sad to see, but you know, that's life. So yeah. So this week I did an obstacle course, an 8-kilometer obstacle course out in the desert. The desert's kind of grim. Like the desert, you have this idea of the desert. Like the desert's just a shithole, basically. It's just like full of like dead stuff, and you know, it's not Lawrence of Arabia. You know, you go out there, there's lots of plastic bags, and it's really not nice. And so I did this obstacle course. One of these, it's named after, you know, it's like the Spartan or the you know, the Trojan or some kind of condom kind of. Named after a condom or something, race out in the desert, and you have to go over like obstacles and all that kind of stuff. So it was quite good fun, really. Not like an amazing runner. Like I can run like 10K or something, and it was quite hot, being the desert, and it was a bit of a sandstorm and stuff, and you had to climb over things and go through water and all that kind of stuff. The what is funny though, because you're living in like an Arab country, it's funny like men go around holding each other's hands, and men are very like kind of intimate with each other, like kissing each other and very kind of touchy feely. But you know, like women, definitely not. You know, no one's even looking at. You're not even supposed to look at the women, not let alone do anything else. So if you this is really, you know, this is not a place to live if you're gay, definitely. You probably would, you know, something. It was just not good. It's not good to be gay here. But if you were gay, it's a perfect place to live, because you can like walk around with your arms around someone or holding a man's hand. As long as you don't start kissing, you're well away. So there is a lot. Someone told me that here there's a lot of, you know, it's like a lot of people from like Indian subcontinent. There's like, you know, 10,000 men to every woman. So, you know, maybe that's why people walk around holding hands. I don't know. But anyway, someone told me a funny story that the women here, like if you're a woman, like when you're driving, there's a lot of like police, security, you know, being stopped by the security. And what the women do, they put their ID pass like in between their legs. So they open the window and the pass is just there. And like, you know, they've got like a bear crawl and all this kind of stuff. They have it between their legs, so the policeman, he can't reach in and get it. Otherwise, you know, it's just not going to happen. So it's kind of a cool little. If you're writing a book about someone dressing up and trying to get out of an Arab country as a woman, that's a good little technique for you there to use. So, but anyway, but on this race, there is a point to the story. On this race, they had one of these really high, you know, like full metal, not full metal jacket. Yeah, full metal jacket where you have to climb up. You know, like, what's your malfunction? You know, hey, I'm nuts, all that kind of stuff. You have to climb up it. And there's this poor woman who was kind of stuck at the top. She's kind of, you know, when you go over under one of those things, net climbing things, you're, you know, supposed to kind of, you know, grab all the top and like swing both legs over. But she kind of ended up sitting on the top and just thinks she thought she was going to topple over. And there was a guy below, like, trying to talk her down. And then I went up there and it's really difficult. You don't know if you should touch somebody or where you should touch them, or it's really odd. You know, it's a really odd kind of thing where, you know, probably I think I just like grabbed hold of a t-shirt and I just like started pushing her off, like, oh, you know, oh, I thought you were scared before, didn't you? You're really scared now. I remember that when I climbed this like TV program with this the Alex Jones woman. I've mentioned it before in this podcast, but I remember we took her to some tower somewhere, and they had these ropes hanging down, the castle climbing wall. There are these static ropes hanging down in this tower, and I was trying to teach her how to Jumar. So we were like Jumaring up this rope, and she was like being totally BBC, like someone was filming. It's like, so tell me, Andy, how are these ropes made? And then Jumar a bit further. So tell me, Andy, what's the breaking strain of this Jumar and all that kind of. And then I was like, do you feel safe? Do you feel safe, Alex? She was, oh yeah, I feel amazingly safe. I said, would you feel safe if it got windy? And I started like pushing her around, like, whoa. And she was like, fucking get off me. So, look, if someone's really afraid, if you make them even more afraid, then they're less afraid when you stop doing what you were doing to them. But anyway, but I didn't win. I came halfway through the field. I think it was like 190 out of like 200 or something. I think Vanessa was like 20, so she was quite good out of the women. All the other women had burkas on, so they were tripping up all the time. So this sort of coincides with the subject matter of this podcast, which is the subject of failure. Someone asked me about, could I talk about failure? Now, failure is, failure is my middle name, if you want to know about failure. So someone told me recently they were a teacher and they had a sports day, and there's four houses. And basically the three top houses, they all got a medal. And then the last house, they didn't get a medal. And then one of the parents was so outraged that they went out and bought medals for the house that had lost, which kind of, I think the thing about failure is it's really good to know you failed. It's really good to, really be beaten. Really, really, totally be beaten, and have no doubt that you failed, and to go through the stages of failure where you blame someone else and you blame the weather, then you blame, then you get sad, and then you get happy. But actually, the phases of failure. If you're climbing, say you're trying to do some really hard route, is say you're like halfway up a big wall and you bail. Is when you get to the ground, the first feeling is of like elation because you survived. And, when you're trying to get down off something and you're trying to, once you've given up on something, the next goal is to get down. And then when you achieve that goal, it's like really quite good. And I often think it's a shame that people like rush through the elation of succeeding in failing. And they just get straight onto the like being pissed off and upset and blaming everybody and saying they're never going to do it again and throwing all the gear in the river and all that kind of stuff. Should really try and make the most of that feeling. But I think the more you fail, the more you enjoy it. Do you know what I mean? The more you enjoy that feeling. Like if anybody's seen the TED. There's like a TEDx lecture of me talking, and I talk way too fast. I'm like, blah, 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 blah. I basically did like a 40 minute lecture in about 15 minutes or something, 20 minutes. But I'm talking about going to solo the troll wall, and how after about 10 days on the troll wall, like no one had ever soloed like a technical route on the troll wall. I think people had soloed the Rimmen route. Someone saw the Rimmen route, but you're up on this wall for like 10 days, sort of kind of scary climbing, like loose and all that kind of stuff. I had a few epics, but I'm on the very last 35 meters of the last pitch, and I just can't find a belay. And in the process of trying to work out what to do, my camera got switched on, and I just heard my son saying like, Dad, get away. Like, and he was just some footage of him like emptying bottles of lemonade. This probably doesn't make any sense. You'd have to watch the video. But I decided I had to retreat from the wall, and I ended up taking me like maybe 2 days to rappel all the way back down this like 600, 650 meter, big wall. I think it was 600 meters. Anyway, it was a long way. It took me 2 days to get down, very overhanging. Anyway, I got down and I was on such a high because I was like, I just on a high for ages and ages, like probably weeks, if not months. It was just such a, it was the right thing to do. That's the main thing, is when you fail, it is don't start questioning why you did something when you're, sat in the bath. You know, you just got to remember what it felt like at that moment. Like you were the best person to make that choice, potentially. 50% of you was the right person. Sometimes you always have to be careful of like a failure looking for an excuse, which is sort of very, very common, where people have these great ideas, these great ambitions, and they set off up something and very quickly they realise it's not what they thought it was going to be. Like climbing a big wall isn't all romantic and, you know, cool and high-fiving each other. It's just a sweaty, horrible, you know, experience. It's like having a full-time job or something in a factory, you know. It's not that nice. So people don't like it. And they're shit at it as well, and they make loads of mistakes and drop stuff, and they start making all these reasons why they have to go back down, and, you know, and then they end up bailing, and then they get down, and they start telling you all these stuff like, oh, the whole bag was too heavy because we had too much water, and also we didn't think we had enough water. You know, all these kind of things. So, yes, that's always a good thing to be wary of failure. Like, is your heart really in it at the beginning? And sometimes you need to kind of do something a few times. You know, it's like, do you know, if you get into really, really hot, like sauna, you know, not a sauna, like a really hot, like pool of water, you know, you start going in there and like, oh, Christ, this is way too hot. And he just comes back out again. And then you think about it. Then you go in again, you go a bit further and you're like, oh God. And then, you know, you keep trying, eventually you get in there. And after a while, you're like, oh, it's actually a bit too cool, a bit too cold now. So, you know, the classic, what would be a thing would be like wanting to climb the nose, you know, like all climbers want to climb the nose, you know, and is that you know, you find this climbing partner, you both want to climb the nose, you go to Yosemite, you know, you do a little bit of training, the climbing wall, you go to Yosemite, you try it, you do two pitches, you can't do it, you bail, you make all these excuses, you bail, and you go back down, your partner's like, oh, it's shit, you know, and you're like, oh, it's shit, you come home, and then your partner's like, I'm never doing that again, but you're like, actually, it was shit, but I actually quite enjoyed it, and maybe I can see what I didn't understand or what I didn't learn, I didn't know properly. So you start training some more. You know, you read more books, you talk to more people, you find another climbing partner. You go back and you try and climb the nose again, and you get like five pitches up, but then there's people are really slow in front of you, and it gets really, really hot. And you start doubting if that original failure was actually due to the fact that you just don't want to do it. And you sort of let that get into your head, and you're like, oh, this is shit, let's go back down. So you go back down, but luckily you give yourself like 3 weeks. So you do a bit of climbing, and the more you sort of hang around in the valley, your psyche starts going back up again. And then you realize that, you know, if you don't do it now, you're never coming back here ever again. And, you know, you're going to look a bit stupid. So you go do another route that's easier. You know, you do like Leaning Tower or something, and everything seems to work a lot better. You work out all your mistakes, and then you go back on the nose, and this time you set off at like 3 a.m. and you have a lot less stuff, and you already know the first 5 pitches, you whiz up them, and you keep on going, you make loads of fucking mistakes, you nearly die, you pull rocks on yourself, you know, you shit your pants, all that kind of stuff. But after 5 days with your 3 days of water, you get to the top. And so sometimes failure is not like, you know, unless you get killed, it's not necessarily the end of something, you know. Like sometimes literally it can be like the beginning of something. I've met loads of people who their first experience of climbing or ice climbing or whatever, mountaineering, was like really, really, really negative, a really negative experience. But for some reason, they just, like my first alpine route was doing like the Frendo Spur, like a winter ascent of the Frendo Spur. And I bloody hated every minute of it, like really, really hated every minute of it. But at the same time, and also I tried it once with somebody and we failed. And then I tried it again with somebody else and I dropped my boot and then I tried it again and we got to the top. But, you know, like, I really hated it every time I went up there. I really don't like it. I don't like alpine climbing. It's just cold, miserable and scary and dangerous. And you spend loads of time just sitting around, not doing anything because the weather's bad. It's just like the worst thing you could ever do in your life. But for some reason, it's also like probably one of the coolest things you'll ever do. So it just like draws you back. So yeah, it's, so what's that film? Is it a film? No, what's the book, Thingy in a Time of Cholera, oh God, what's it called? Anyway, there's that book where the guy is on a boat and he's a virgin, and he I think some woman, like, he's on this boat on the river in the Amazon or somewhere, and the woman like pulls him to this room, this strange woman, and has sex with him, and then throws him out the door again, and then he doesn't know who it was or anything. It's like totally. There's an also, it's actually probably based on, is it Dostoevsky book, story where a man is like in a dark room, a soldier, and this woman like kisses him, but doesn't know who it was. It's really, really sad, really. He never finds out who it was, and he just wants to be kissed again by this person. So it's a bit like that alpine climbing, basically, is, you know, it's like having the best kiss or the best shag ever, and then just wanting it to happen again, and just hanging around. Hopefully it's going to happen again. You know, it's like going to the same disco every night because you once had a really great shag with someone and you didn't know who it was. You know, that's probably, I doubt Walter Bonatti or Chris Bonington ever put it like that, but it's a little bit like that. You're just kind of hanging on. Basically, you're stalking, basically. You're stalking something, you don't even know what it is. So I guess you'd say you kind of got to give yourself room to fail, if that makes any sense. Like, you've got, if you go there, when the British went to Afghanistan or Iraq, they said like failure is not an option. Like, that is a fucking stupid sort of way to approach anything in your life. You know, failure is kind of like, is probably the default, the default outcome. That's kind of what you want in life. You don't want to be doing anything where you're not going to fail at it. Like, what is the point of doing it? Like, you know, like, set your dream a little bigger. Do you know what I mean? So giving yourself room to fail and kind of courting failure by trying something. Instead of going to Yosemite, say, and saying we're going to do, like, you know, west face of Washington, we're going to do Washington Column or something, you know, and then we're going to go back in another year or 2 years, and then we're going to might try and do Leaning Tower. And we're like, I'm always just like, just fucking invest some time in training, you know, sort out your Jumar ring, your hauling and all that kind of stuff here, and just get there, get straight on the nose or get straight on LCAP, or just, there's a point where life is too short to, you know, you got to really train for it. You got to just like rock up and do it. Some people do, but most people don't. But, you know, if whatever it is, you don't want to tempt failure. You don't want to like magnify the chances of failure by something that is not. There's so many reasons why you're going to fail to do something. Don't increase them. You know, like I probably, when I went to Denali last year, I probably wasn't fit enough. I probably put too much thought into some things and not enough thought into my fitness, just because I was kind of, it was hard to get. That, well, just not in a place where it was very easy to get fit enough for what I was going to do. So that's a problem for a lot of people. It's just finding the time to do all these things. I have this little story. I was going to write this, like, when I was 18 or 19. I had this like great idea that I was gonna sell T-shirts to students. So to me, like, students, like, I've never been a student, but students always seem to have loads and loads of like free money and just seem to like do bugger all and just like wander around. So I had this idea. I was gonna like do some T-shirts, screen print some T-shirts. So I got my granddad to make me, because granddad was a carpenter, I got him to make me the screen printing, you know, like a piece of, like a frame, like a picture frame with a piece of wood underneath it with a hinge. And then I bought this material. This was like before the internet. So I must have gone to the library and just read how to do it. And so I bought this this fabric that you pull tight and staple it on, and then I bought some ink for doing screen printing. Then I bought loads of T-shirts for, like, I think they were £1 each. And then I did a design, I cut it out of this kind of plasticky, plastic-backed paper. Then I screen printed these T-shirts. And I think you used to get like £26 a week, maybe. It was like £54. Maybe I'm thinking £54 a fortnight, maybe. God, a fortune. So I probably spent like quite a lot of my non-disposable income on this grand plan. And in my head, I'd got this idea I was going to sell all these things and, you know, all these T-shirts, thinking all the money I was going to make and all this kind of stuff. Anyway, so I went down to the student union and they had like a day where anyone could sell whatever they wanted. And stood there all day long, had my T-shirts all laid out, kind of cool sort of design, and I didn't sell a single one. And by the end of the day, just packed them all up and just walked back, and I was the most sorriest fucking person in the world. Like, I just felt like such an idiot. Like, I probably didn't even know the word humiliated at the time, but I just felt I'd humiliated myself, you know. And there's that part of you that's like the overreacher in your nature. Well, in my nature anyway, is someone who is like, you know, I've got all the ambition, but without any of the talent or with any of the sort of foresight or things to make it really, really pull it off, really, the, you know. And I think I'd end up giving all those T-shirts away, and you know, I probably just told myself I would never ever do that again. But of course I did the same kind of things loads of times. I remember I once did this little booklet, I think it's called Solid Air, some people might actually have it somewhere. It's a little kind of booklet, and the idea was just to get loads of bits of writing and stick it in this booklet and make it something nice. And John Barton printed it. I had to pay him, you know. You know, he was a you know, graphic designer, print person. Now he's like one of my publishers. So it's kind of weird you have this relationship with somebody. Anyway, and I got like, I don't know how many print, I got printed like 4,000 of these fucking booklet things. And they're only, you know, if you saw them like in an art shop, they'd be free, you know, like a little kind of thing. But it was like nice paper and it was nice pictures. And, you know, it's a real little collector's kind of thing. And I was talking at the Royal Geographical Society, and I had this idea that I was going to just, you know, sell like loads of them. And I was working out, you know, maybe each one cost me £1. And I was selling for like £4. And, you know, I had all these great ideas. I didn't sell a single one, you know. I just didn't ever sell. And I just never really sold any of them because it was just too expensive for what it was. And it was, but again, it was like another lesson. It was a lesson in failure. And, you know, like I think that's maybe one thing you really have to think about is, what do you gain when you fail at something? Like, what do you gain when you're successful? Like, if I was successful and I'd sold all those books, maybe I would have made, you know, like a few thousand pounds. But the value to me as a person to have not sold any is potentially incalculable. It's like, that's a more positive way of thinking of it. But, you know, like, I guess it's the old Batman thing, isn't it? Like, why do we stumble? You know, all that kind of stuff. But it's really true, really. Because success, like with the Troll Wall story, I eventually came back the following winter and climbed the Troll Wall with two other people. And I ended up climbing that last 35 meters. And what was it worth? It wasn't worth anything. It was like 14 days of your life fucking suffering on a big wall in winter to climb 35 meters to a point which doesn't mean anything whatsoever. Didn't even go to the top of the mountain. So I think if you're not ambitious, you know, then failure isn't really going to be a problem. But if you are ambitious, and most people are ambitious, like, don't let your failures stop you. It's just, again, it's like this thing, like Ella, my daughter, just she's like doing like a maths degree, and she got like a bad result. She's really sad because she's like worked really really hard, and for some reason she's got this like result in her test that wasn't what she thought she was going to get, and you could tell she's like super super sad about it. She's trying to put on a brave face because she's that kind of person. And she was like, oh, maybe I'm just going to start a company with my brother and all that kind of stuff. And I was like, Ella, like, being good at maths, and you are really good at maths, is just the manifestation of who you are. Like, you aren't, it's not that you're, just because you're good at maths doesn't mean that's what you are. You know, like, I'm a mathematician. It's just how it's manifested itself in you. Like, you are someone who is, like, more above average intelligence, who can order complex things in your mind and see patterns in things and understand things other people can't understand. Now, that is like a universal skill that you can apply to anything at all in your life. So that's why people who, you know, used to be rocket engineers ended up making millions on Wall Street, if not billions, because it's, you know. So, yeah, so I think trying to square away your failure is very important, you know. Become sort of friends with it, you know. Ha 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 ha! I failed again, you know. What next? So what's that thing? This is the point where I could add in loads of, you know, cliched kind of things about fail better, blah blah blah, all that kind of stuff, all that kind of self help stuff. But you know, hopefully, you know. So anyway, so I thought I was in my continuing reading training. I thought I'd read this little thing off my website. I've not read through it yet, so it might be terrible. But it's from 2010, and I went out to try and I'd always wanted to solo El Cap in a Day, and I'd actually always wanted to climb El Cap in a Day, and I'd always failed to climb El Cap in a Day. I tried it once. I tried to climb Zodiac in a Day, and I ended up like leading all the pitches for some reason. So I basically got too tired, and we got right up past the Mark of Zorro, like up maybe we're like four pitches from the top, and I was just so tired that I was falling asleep when I was climbing. So we ended up having to stop and bivvy on a tiny little ledge. So I blew it that time. I think then maybe I tried to climb it with somebody else. The same thing. I kind of led all the pitches, which is a mistake. And we climbed it in 30 hours or something. Tried to do the nodes in 30 hours. So I kept failing. And then I had this idea. I was going to go to Antarctica with somebody who was paraplegic. And this idea was, could you ski to the South Pole if you were paraplegic? You know, is it even possible? And it seemed like totally impossible. But I'd also skied across Greenland with her, so I kind of thought maybe it was possible. But the idea was just so crazy, like 1,000 kilometers, just like on a sit ski, skiing along. But then I thought, like, well, maybe what about if you tried to ski all across Antarctica? You know, across Antarctica. Now that's really crazy, you know. And so when I thought about something that was twice as hard, the original thing didn't seem quite as bad as it did. So I kind of applied this to trying to climb El Cap in a Day. I decided if I couldn't climb El Cap in a Day, I'd try and solo it in a day instead. So I actually went out and I actually did some proper training. I actually got really fit that time. I was like running up a big hill every day, and I was eating properly and taking care of myself. And I went out there. And I think I tried to climb Lake Fear to begin with. Got up at 1 a.m, started climbing, and then I got like a cam totally jammed, like one of those they're not a fixed cam because they're always fixed. A link cam got it stuck, so I was basically blew it. I had to come back down, and then I went to try and do Zodiac in a Day, and when I got to the bottom, there was these two guys like sleeping at the bottom, and I set off, and I got like two pitches up, and then I dropped my aider, So I'd blown it again. So I just abseiled down and like bivvied at the bottom. And in the morning, I woke up and these other guys were there and the guys were kind of humming and hawing. And they were like, oh, we don't think we've got time actually to do Zodiac. We really want to do it. Jordan and I can't remember his name. They didn't have time. They didn't have time to do it. So I was like, well, why don't we like team up and we'll do it together? We'll try and do it in a day together. You know, not telling them I'm not climbing a day before. And they obviously assumed that because I just tried to do it solo in a day, I must be like this super wad climber. So we went, I think we went down, got some food, you know, whatever. Then we came up and then we bivvied at the bottom and then we set off the next day and we did it in a day. We did it in like 14 hours, 15 hours or something, got to the top. So that kind of showed you that that did actually work. You know, it went from being impossible to much easier than the alternative. But I actually went back a few days later and I tried again to try and solo it in a day. So this was just something I wrote at the time. I don't think I've ever reread it. I should have put it, I wrote this book, Unknown Pleasures, which is like an amalgamation. It's like, you know, greatest hits of writing, and there's some all sorts of stuff in there, but this isn't in there for some reason. So I've not read it. So anyway, so this was, from 2010, and this was written while I was in Yosemite. So here we go, put on my best reading voice. Let's get this right. Right. I'm sat in my usual spot in the Yosemite Lodge cafeteria, typing out words with sausage fingers, my hips and feet aching with a dull throbbing pain, my head full of fog. I feel as if I've been run over or been cage fighting. It's Friday at 7:30 p.m. Oh no, on Friday at 7:30 p.m, I started up Zodiac for my fifth time and the second time that week. With just 3 litres of water, a single rope, two sets of batteries for my head torch and a minimalist rack, I don't think I'd ever felt so committed in my life. The first two pitches were climbed, rappelled and cleaned in 90 minutes. And as the valley drew dark, I pressed on, climbing as fast as I could, set up a belay, abseil back to my last belay, take the belay apart, grab my pack, jug up the rope, cleaning gear and repeat. When I got up that morning, I'd felt tired, still recovering from climbing El Cap in 19 hours. 2 days before, and compounded by a week of disturbed sleep before that. And so it was a bit of a surprise to me that I was trying to climb non-stop. This was borne out at around 2 a.m. when I began to feel very tired, felt the agonizing desire to lay down and sleep. As it was pitch six, I decided I should try and sleep for 2 hours to recharge my batteries. So I sat there and fell into a half sleep for 15 minutes, then woke as the moon came up. Sat there in the dark on a tiny ledge, I began to feel scared, like a free diver who was unsure if he had enough oxygen to make it to the surface. My mind was full of doubts, such as if I was going too slow, if I had enough water, the fact after this pitch, I would find it almost impossible to get down with only one rope. I imagined that hand on the tiller and told myself to be calm and to get moving, as action would dispel my fears. I arrived at the White Circle at dawn and started up the Crux pitches, which aren't too hard, but I felt as if I was going slower. My mind seemed to be drifting, wasting precious seconds on tangling slings or watching silverfish swarm on the wall. But again and again, I would snap to and remind myself that I couldn't dawdle. I had to climb before my water ran out. My first big problem came when I had to abseil back down to my lead rope on several of the traversing pitches, necessitating scary back cleaning on the way up and much jiggery pokery on the way down. Again and again, I found myself spinning a long way out from the deck, trying to get a piece of gear so I could pass it. Each time I did this, I felt time slipping through my fingers. At 7:30 p.m., I was still 4 pitches from the top. I had been climbing non-stop for 24 hours and awake for 36. I felt no surge of disappointment when I saw the time, as I'd known for the last 7 hours I couldn't make it. Now I just wanted out and entered the terrible space of the failed speed climber, who was forced to confront the wall with little in the way of food, water or energy as night comes on, only without the dream of success to power him. But now my harness was doing me grievous damage, and my feet felt sore and my hands ached from dew marring, but with nowhere even to stand, I had to dig deep until I could reach Peanut Ledge, a surfboard-sized ledge for one, three pitches from the top. It grew dark, and my pace slowed to survival mode. Focus, focus, focus. I pulled onto the ledge around 10 p.m. and sat there for an interminable time, knowing I had to wrap down and get my pack, but seemingly not being able to move. I realised I was taking micro naps, a tiny burst of uncontrollable sleep. I knew I was in great danger if I didn't pay attention, but all I wanted to do was crawl up on that ledge and sleep, my mind trying to convince me to just have a sleep and recharge. Then I could wrap down and get my stuff, a trick that would only lead me to wake more hungry and thirsty and with lower energy. And yet still, I just sat there, my legs over the edge, trying to move, but unable to do so. I knew my mind had space free for tiredness in which I could operate, and I visualised a citadel within it, an impregnable fortress in which my core function was safe from sleep. Everything else, memory, desire, and dreams, were consumed by the darkness. This skeleton crew of still firing neurons got moving, and down I went, got my stuff and jugged back, flaking out on the ledge as soon as I got there, my legs in my rope bag, a bothy bag, my only insulation. So tired, I slept, still attached to my Jumars on the rope. The sleep was cold and heavy, my mind signalling every time I came close to waking that I'm on a tiny ledge in El Cap and make sure you're still attached. The moon came up and so did the cramps. I knew that the top was only 3 pitches away, and there lay lots of bottles of water, but it might as well have been a million miles. I thought about my folly and that something was deeply wrong with me to be unsatisfied with climbing this route in a day with partners, as if that was easy, and so I was trying the impossible. If I'd done this, then what would be next? I topped out at lunchtime and sat under a tree and had a drink of a big bottle of water before I could find the energy to wrap and jug one final time. It seemed I was cursed never to just sit in the shade, always something to do. My rucksack up, I sat under the tree again, knowing I should go down, falling in and out of sleep, feeling dejected and foolish to have tried such a thing. I tried to find some satisfaction that I'd soloed a wall in 30 hours that usually took a party 4 or 5 days, but it was no good. I knew I'd simply deluded myself. The walk down was tougher than usual, as all I wanted to do was lay down and sleep. But on I went until I reached my car and just sat there feeling empty. My emotions primarily dictated by lack of sleep than anything. Then out of nowhere, an old man appeared, dressed like a scout leader. "Did you just climb El Cap, young man?" he said. I think I recognise your rucksack. I watched you this morning in my binoculars. "Yes, I did," I replied sheepishly. "Well, well done, young man," he said, holding out his hand. "That's a mighty impressive thing you've done," he said, smiling. I sat back in my car and thought it disingenuous to feel anything but pride for oneself for climbing El Cap, a rock with no bad routes and no bad climbs. So I'm sat here recovering in the cafeteria, my eyes heavy. I know when I stop hurting, I'll be stronger. And the lack of pain is just a sign that you're getting weak. I have enough time, maybe enough energy, to try once more, again, a sub-24-hour solo ascent of El Cap, probably lurking fear, as I just can't bring myself to do Zodiac again. In the food queue a few minutes ago, I found myself behind two young black guys, one a minister and the other a soldier on leave. The soldier told the minister he was going to Afghanistan in a week's time and that he was worried about it. The minister just looked at him and said, "I'm sure it will bring you closer to God. Amen." There you go. So another bit of reading. Something to think about. Failure. Don't be afraid of it. It's part of life. So I'll see you again on Tuesday. Goodbye.